about what David does in preparation and hands stuff over to Solomon. We have quite a few chapters in the book of First Chronicles that we have to cover. And then we'll bounce around a little bit here at the end of Second Samuel. This pretty well completes our look into Second Samuel. We'll roll into First Kings on Wednesday night. So for a quick review, on Wednesday night, I talked about David wanted a census, and we see that Joab had tried to inform him that it wasn't necessary, and I think I remember Tim saying something like, you know, it's very difficult to understand Joab, and because he seems to at times do exactly what David wants him to do, and at other times does the exact opposite of what David wants him to do. And yet at times he has very good instinct and information trying to inform David to do things that he should. But here's a case where David decides that he wants to take a census of the people. Joab tries to, you know, discourage him from doing so, but he does it anyway. Then we discuss briefly about David realizing his sin, and then got three options. Then ultimately he builds that altar at the threshing floor of Arana. Then I think you wound up and ended up in David's song of praise in Samuel, in 2 Samuel, the 22nd chapter, and on into the beginning part of 23, verses 1 through 7. A beautiful prayer, and Tim talked a lot about that. So today we'll begin. We actually roll back into the 21st chapter as we begin, and we look at verses 15 through 22. This is also parallel with 1 Chronicles chapter 20, verses 4 through 8. And we have this... we have this several stories told of David, especially apparently in his aging years, because we'll see here in the next couple of verses that what his men do in response to some of these battles. So in verse 15, it says, "Now when the Philistines were at war with Israel, David went down and his servants with him, and they fought as they fought against the Philistines." James, can you turn that down just a bit? Thank you. And in verse 16, and I'm going to butcher this giant's name, but it's Ishbi-benob, who was among the descendants of the giants, the weight of whose spear was 300 shekels of bronze in weight, was girded with a new sword, and he intended to kill David. So David engages in this battle. And in verse 17, we see Abishai comes in and helps him to defeat the giant. But at the end of 17, it says, "Then the men of David swore to him, saying, 'You shall not go out again with us in battle, so that you do not extinguish the lamp of Israel.'" So I think one of the questions that is in your book kind of talks about, why is it that we think that his men would have told him, "You're not going to come back out into battle with us"? They didn't want him to be killed, and he was probably at this point also a little bit older in his age than he was when he killed Goliath, right? So we know that he was a valiant man. We know that he fought well, but here at this point, at the end of verse 15, it says David became weary. And so here's a man who has increased in age. And unfortunately, the older we get, we always can't do what we used to could do, right? I can't do what I did when I was 20, even though I'm only 22, right? So it just happens that way. So David is obviously... are apparently getting much older. We see him trying to go out there and battle with his men, but he gets in a situation here where Abishai helps him out, and then they say, okay, that's enough. We don't need you to die because you are the lamp of Israel. And then in verses 18 through 22, we see several other giants who have been slain, and we see some of the men who slay them. And that kind of wraps up the look back. Then we see in chapter 23, beginning in verse 8, and also in 1 Chronicles chapter 11, we see a significant list of David's mighty men. And we see a couple of stories of them. Here are the more significant ones. A lot of them we don't necessarily have very detailed stories on, but the ones that we have some stories on here in chapter 23 and in chapter 11 of 1 Chronicles are the first three. I think someone else should read these out loud. But Jehoshabim, Eleazar, Shammah. Those are the top three that are referenced in both of these chapters, and they become the top tier. There's a top tier of these men, and those men kind of stood out above the rest. And so these three men, it talks about some of their battles, okay? So in 2 Samuel 23:8, it talks about Josh Besheth, which should be the same name as the first one listed here. It says he killed 800 at one time. In First Chronicles chapter 11, it talks about the fact that he killed 300 at one time. Eleazar said that, you know, he stood up in a plot in a field with David, and they took on all comers. Then we see that that Shammah also gathered into a field, and he took on the Philistines single-handedly. So these men were ones that we would consider, you know, of mighty valor. So, you know, we have wars today, and what do we do to the men who excel in them? What's that? We elect them sometimes. We elevate them, right? We give them medals usually. And of course, the top medal that we give to someone of war is the Medal of Honor, right? And so there are not many that survive those incidents where they were able to gain such valor to be recognized at that level. Yet here are men that fought with David, and these top three have proven themselves over and over again in situations where it was pretty shocking that they were even to live. But in verse 10 of 2 Samuel chapter 23, and in verse 12 of 2 Samuel chapter 23, there's a common phrase. And what is that phrase that we see in those two verses? Yeah, the Lord brought about a great victory. So I think it's really important that we, and also in First Chronicles 11, we also see a similar statement. The third man's valor is not discussed in First Chronicles 11, but we see even when Eleazar is discussed in 1 Chronicles 11, that there's a comment about that was brought on by the Lord. And so even when they look back upon these men and what they did, they can attribute it to the fact that the Lord was with them. All right. Now, there's a unique story that happened with these three men and David, and it happened when Bethlehem was under siege. And David and a number of his men are held up in a cave, and David makes a comment and says, I sure would like some water from the well right outside the gate of Bethlehem. And then what do these three do? Yeah. They went through an entire Philistine garrison, right, that was encamped there in Bethlehem. They fought their way through, drew water from the well, and then brought it back to David. What was David's reaction to that? What's that? He poured it out, but do you think he was probably surprised that somebody actually came up to him and handed him a cup of water from the well? That's right. And so he considered that water so valuable that he could not just drink it himself. So it says that he poured it out as a drink offering to God, right? Because of what those men went through to get it. And so these three men that were considered kind of the top of the mighty men certainly have earned their place there. It's pretty surprising some of the things that we read here and imagine men at that time were able to do. Then we have kind of the next tier. I think there are apparently two tiers of three, but the next tier we only have two that are mentioned, and those are the next two, Abishai and Benaiah. So Abishai we're familiar with. He's the brother of Joab and the one who has been with David many times. And so on one occasion, it talks about the fact that he was able to, in verse 18 of 2 Samuel, he was able to swing his spear and kill up to 300 men, and he was most honored of the men, except for the top three that are mentioned, and then we see a story of Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, the son of a valiant man of Kabzeel, who had done, this is verse 20, who had done mighty deeds, killed two sons of Ariel of Moab, and also went down and killed a lion in the middle of the pit on a snowy day. He killed an Egyptian, it says an impressive man. Now the Egyptian had a spear in his hand, but he went down to him with a club, snatched the spear from the Egyptian's hand and killed him with his own spear. So, obviously a skilled fighter, and another one of the top tiered of the mighty men. Then we have a list of a significant number of the mighty men. Now it says of the 30, the first list there in chapter 24, or 23, list 37, and then if you go over to First Chronicles, you'll see about 50 listed there. But I would say that there were times when people passed and other people took their place and they just had a more complete list. But a couple of the folks that we see in this list, the first one listed is Asahel, and he's the brother of Joab and brother of Abishai. And we've talked about him before. He was the very fast runner and a skilled man as well, but then he was killed by whom? By Abner, right? He was killed by Abner whenever he was trying to pursue Abner. He shouldn't have been trying to pursue Abner, but he was. And Abner stuck the spear down and allowed that to thrust him through. It's also what got Abner killed, because Joab took revenge. Right. And then we see listed, and in 2 Samuel in verse 39, the last one listed there is Uriah the Hittite. And we know that, you know, that is was the husband of Bathsheba, and the one whom David himself had to come up with a plan with, and they withdrew from him, and he was killed. But he was considered among those of mighty men of David. All right, so that kind of concludes the look back over some of the stories and the mighty men who helped support David. Are there any other comments anyone wants to make about that? No, you make a good point, Randy. The physical battles that these men fought versus the spiritual battles that we need to be valiant in today. And yeah, he had a whole plethora of men who were considered mighty, but shouldn't we today have that same kind of zeal and be able to battle that same kind of will, but in a spiritual sense? That's a good point. And it's tough, as you said in the beginning, our body changes as we age, right? And sometimes it's difficult to transition from one who did a lot to now one who is unable to do some because of the physical limitations. But we still have roles. Right? We still have roles. Yes. Good point. I'll recap because I know from watching online it's difficult to hear what is being said. So it's not that I'll probably butcher it, but I hope I get the spirit of what Albert was saying, is that these men fought for a specific cause and they had one that created the ability for them to fight in ways at this time that even warriors much later, even those who conquered the world, did not have that same kind of ability or that, because they didn't have that cause that they were driven for. And then, tying it back over into the spiritual side, we also have that same cause today, right? We have a cause and we have to fight like these men did. Tying it back to what Randall was saying, the spiritual battles that we have to engage in are extremely difficult. Yet, if we have that understanding of the cause and why we're fighting, just like these men did, then we also can be mighty men for God. Right. And I think that's the right. And I think that's why it's important that when we see that comment about the great thing that the Lord gave to them, right? That ties that back. But you're right. The faith that they had entering into some of these battles had to have been great because they understood which side they were fighting on, and it was the right side. So, that's right. It's just killing. That's right. So, this ties in with things that we also see early in David's life about him inquiring of the Lord, right? Before they entered into many of these things, what was it that he did? He inquired of the Lord. He understood whether he should be doing these certain things or not. And then we see him stumble throughout this, you know, throughout his later years in that. But he comes back. And I think the end here, the next portion here is we'll go into First Chronicles, and we'll start in chapter 22. And we'll go through chapter 29 here pretty quick. But we see this story of, you know, a little bit more of David and not all of his battles and his exploits, right? But we see the man and what he did along the way. And so in First Chronicles chapter 22, we read of David preparing the material, not only the labor, I mean, not only the material, but the labor for the building the temple. And if we remember, you know, David back in, what was it, 2 Samuel, the 8th chapter, I believe, right? 7th chapter, thank you. Back in 2 Samuel, the 7th chapter, David wanted to go and build a temple for the Lord. And then he receives a, you know, understanding, I think it was at Gad at that time, who was still Nathan. Yeah, you're right. Gad was Nathan. So that he tells Nathan this. Nathan then that night receives word from God and tells him he does not want him to build the temple. But that doesn't stop David from doing the things that he felt like he needed to do. And we see a little bit of his character coming through here, because it says that he gave orders to the foreigners who were in the land. He set some to be stone cutters, to hew out stones. He began the collection of large quantities of bronze and iron for the gates and for nails. He had already made arrangements for a significant amount of timber, for cedar to come down. So he prepped the battlefield, if you will, of accomplishing this significant task. One that he says, you know, here I live in this wonderful, solid house, and yet God and his ark is sitting in a tent, right? That's wrong. And you see that he doesn't just stand back and say, wow, that's wrong. He actually acts on trying to make that, you know, corrected. And so in chapter 22, beginning of verse 6, we see him charging Solomon with the task of, you know, building this temple. It talks about some pretty amazing pieces here as far as how much he has prepared. In verse 14, it talks about, behold, I with great pains I have prepared for the house of the Lord 100,000 talents of gold, 1,000,000 talents of silver, and bronze and iron beyond weight, for they are in great quantity. Also timber I have prepared, and you may add to them. So he has been stockpiling a significant amount of materials from the beginning. We can also see that, I think it's in 2 Samuel 8, that was my reference, to 2 Samuel 8, verse 11, we see that he was paid some spoils from a battle that was won, and the statement is made there, and he set aside a portion of that to the house of the Lord. As he conquered people, as he took the spoils of the land and expanded his kingdom, which, if we remember, the map changed significantly from Saul to David. He took a major portion of that and set it aside and stored it up so that when this day came, it would be ready for them to build the temple. And then in verse 19, I have that listed on here, but I think it's important for us to actually read this statement. Now set your heart and your soul to seek the Lord your God. Arise, therefore, and build the sanctuary of the Lord God, so that you may bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and the holy vessels of God into the house that is built for the name of the Lord." He truly wants Solomon to set himself, set the sights on what he needs to do here. Now, in chapter 23, we see he numbers the Levites and the three families that are there. They all had specific roles when we talk about the temple. Right? And when we talk about the tabernacle and then moving through the wilderness, right? There were ones that had to break down the structures and carry them. There were ones who had to carry the emblems or all of the pieces. And then there were ones that actually did the acts of the priest. Now, who were the only ones in the tribe of Levite that could actually be the high priest? Right. They had to directly descend from Aaron, right? And so those are the ones who are the high priest, and then the Kohathites are the ones who actually could have the priest among them, but of those families. So David counts them. Now, didn't we just study on Wednesday night David counting people? Yeah. What's different this time? Or is it? That's right. Right. So one was a lot more selfish, right? Or maybe puffing oneself up to understand what they've accomplished, whereas this is much more tied to we have a task at hand and we need to separate out people to do these tasks. And I think also as we begin in chapter 23, beginning in verse 24 through the end of the chapter, we see that David makes a comment about, okay, the tabernacle is not going to move anymore, and this is going to be a temple, and it's going to be a static structure. Right? So aren't the duties of those Levites going to change? It doesn't make sense that the duty of you and your family would be the one to tear down the poles of the tabernacle and move them when there is no tabernacle anymore. So David begins to reassign some of the tasks and changes those duties for them. Talks about how someone should be there to prepare and measure out the various sacrifices, making the showbread, some cleaning it, some making sure that that they guard the palace, etc. But still, there are only certain ones that are actually allowed to make the sacrifices themselves. But the entire tribe of Levi should be there to help support them and make sure that they have everything that they need. All their utensils are clean, etc. So he kind of revises their duties, and then he divides up some of the duties of the Levites in the 24th chapter. He lists the priest and who they are and where they need to be from. And chapter 25, and I'm sorry I had to move pretty fast, but unless you want to hear me stumble through a whole bunch of names, it's probably not going to be a lot of help. But in chapter 25, we see him assign out some of the musicians, and specifically the three men that are named there. Asaph. We see his name appear a lot in the Book of Psalms, right? We remember that, and he was one of the three men who were set in charge of the musicians, and we see that there were 200 in verse 7, chapter 25, verse 7. And in all that were skilled and trained in singing to the Lord, there were about 288. And so it's constantly establishing this pattern of having about 24 groups that were laid down as he divided up the labor. And in chapter 26, we see the gatekeepers, those who took care of the treasury, and then some judges and or officers for those that had duties that were outside of Jerusalem themselves. It's a good point about David changing the pattern, right? And he did so with God's permission here. We see in I think it's chapter 28, whenever David lays out some of the details of the of how the temple was going to be, that he says that he did all of that according to the Lord, right? So the Lord has entrusted him. David did have to make changes because, like I said earlier, and you know, you made the point, right? It doesn't make sense that you would have a group of the Levites whose duties were to, you know, come and pick up the articles of the tabernacle and move them somewhere when you don't have a tabernacle anymore and it's not moving. Right? So there's something that needed to be done. There was a change. It was a pattern that was established, and then, as you said, people then began to refer back to the pattern that David ordained, and then how the apostles have ordained a pattern through Christ in the New Testament. Very good point. Randall made a reference to Amos, the sixth chapter, where it seems that David may have gone beyond slightly the pattern that the Lord had given him, because it's a good point that the Chronicles are simply there as recorded for what had happened. Right? But these through chapter 26, 4, 5, and 6 are really where the divisions of labor are given to the Levites. And the next three chapters, in chapter 27, he then begins to break out the number of men and how they're to be divided into the army, and talks about some of the chief officers and the counselors that were there as well. Chapter 28 specifically gets into a lot of the it doesn't tell us all, but it does tell us that David gave his detailed designs of how much certain things should weigh and how the layout should be, exactly the way the temple should look, as he received them from the Lord. And he hands that over to Solomon. And in verse 19, there's a couple of couple of verses I highlighted in 28 when I read, when I was reading through it. In verse 9, at the end of it, he makes a statement to Solomon, if you seek him, he will let you find him, but if you forsake him, he will reject you forever. In verse 19, it says, all this, said David, the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me all the details of this pattern. Verse 20, then David said to his son Solomon, be strong and courageous and act. Do not fear or be dismayed, for the Lord God, my God, is with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you until the work for the service of the house of the Lord is finished. All right, I think on Wednesday night we talked about hearing some words that we sing in songs. There's several in there as well that we sing songs that help remind us of being strong and courageous and seeking him. And so in here in 28, this design of the temple and what the instructions are that he gave to Solomon are prevalent. Then in chapter 29, we have this time where everyone is gathered together, and David talks about the offerings, and he challenges all the men of Israel there, or talks to them about the fact that Solomon, his son, is still young and is inexperienced. And then David himself talks about him giving over a significant amount of gold and silver, willingly giving that as an offering to the temple. And then the people who were gathered there apparently were prepared for this, because they themselves gave a significant amount of gold and silver, as well as brass and iron. And it says that in verse 29:9, then the people were rejoiced because they had offered so willingly, for they made their offering to the Lord a whole heart. And King David also rejoiced greatly. Beginning in verse 10 through 19, we see David offering a prayer. And I just had some comments about the prayer, but you see that it's a beautifully worded prayer. I think one that we should definitely consider whenever we pray today. But talks about, it follows, you can certainly see a lot of the Psalms in the way, you know, that David writes them in this prayer. But thanks the Lord for everything. Then says that, you know, he really has everything anyway, and we're just a sojourner in verse 15 before you. I think that also as he's aging, he realizes that this life is really short and we're just passing through. And we see those words in this prayer. And then in the end, I think one of the key things is, give my son Solomon a perfect heart to keep your commandments, your testimonies, and your statutes, and to do them all, and to build this temple. And he's still very concerned about the hearts of men. He's concerned about the heart of his son, and everything that he's gone through, you see that he definitely can understand what happens when you shift your focus and you do not follow. And so his outward prayer here about Solomon and keeping with him, I think, goes a long way early on in Solomon's life. So that's about it. Any other comments? Sorry, I got to put the comment. All right, on Wednesday night, we'll see Solomon begin to take the reins, and then some of the very last things that David tells Solomon before he passes himself.